Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, we're moving on.
Moving on up to the east side, finally getting a piece of the pie. It's our family meeting on Making It on The Brian Lehrer Show today. Let's talk about making it in the age of inequality. Here's a conundrum. If you reject money as the definition of making it, okay, fine, but it's becoming harder to make it as a family, that non-money thing, to even form a family than it once was without money. Call up and tell us, how much do you need your lover to make before you will marry him or her? 212-433-WNYC. Specific question, single people, do you ask yourself this? Do you struggle with it? Do you date on this basis? Call up and tell us, how much do you need your lover to make before you will marry him or her or consider it in anyone you're seeing? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Anyone willing to be honest and candid about this? And with us for this is Naomi Kahn. Also with us, June Carbone. Together, they are authors of a new book called Marriage Markets, How Inequality is Remaking the American Family. They are law professors at George Washington University and the University of Minnesota, respectively. Naomi, June, welcome to WNYC. Hello from New York.
Thanks. Great to be here. Yes, happy to be here. And we definitely think making it means being on your show.
Ha. And I think making it means having you on my show. So part of your premise is that marriage markets are different today than they were in the time of, say, Pride and Prejudice, when the low-income Bennett parents were plotting for the success of their daughters. Listen.
It is taken by a young man of large fortune from the north of England. A single man of large fortune, my dear. What a fine thing for our girls.
How so? How can it affect them?
Oh, Mr. Bennett, how can you be so tiresome? You must know that I'm thinking of his marrying one of them.
For a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife.
Indeed. That from the BBC adaptation in the 90s of Pride and Prejudice, which was set 200 years ago, almost exactly, in 1813. And I guess, June, that's kind of an extreme example from another time and place. You know, for the working class girl to marry a rich guy, and that was the archetypal definition of making it in Pride and Prejudice. But does that set up the premise of your book?
It does. You know, one of the things that I was just in the UK, and I mentioned that history. There's a period not long after the Industrial Revolution where something like 20% of women in England didn't marry at all. And the view was you couldn't get married, the women couldn't get married until they found a guy who had the right amount of income to support them in the manner that befit their status. And there are a lot of jokes, if you look at the historians, about second sons who in an age of primogeniture didn't inherit the family estate, going off to seek their fortunes, and perhaps that really explains the empire. You couldn't get married until you had the right amount of money, the man, and the woman couldn't get married until she had a man with enough money to support her. And that pushed marriage in that era well into the 20s, an extraordinary thing.
Indeed. So flash forward 150 years to the Mad Men era, when we might have thought that professional men were happy to marry their secretaries if they saw them as cute and maybe deferential. That's how we look back on that era. But even then, Joan and Peggy from Mad Men wondered about the optics of one such impending union.
I'll probably make her a copywriter. He's not going to want to be married to his secretary.
Really?
That's the way it works for some.
You know, I just saved this company. I signed the first new business since Lucky Strike left. But it's not as important as getting married. Again.
Well, I was just made director of agency operations. A title, no money, of course. And if they poured champagne, it must have been while I was pushing the mail cart.
A pretty face comes along, and everything goes out the window.
Well, I learned a long time ago to not get all my satisfaction from this job.
That's
All right. That from Mad Men. and my guests, June Carbone and Naomi Kahn, authors of Marriage Markets, How Inequality is Remaking the American Family. And which one of you was laughing there at that fiction and thinking, yeah, that's worth placing as a moment of, you know, fiction in its real life time and context of Marriage Markets? Naomi?
I suspect we were both chuckling about that, just as we think about what's happened to women's status in the United States, what's happened to women's status in the workforce. Today, the women who are most likely to get married and to stay married are women who have a bachelor's degree. So it's the most highly educated women who are most likely to be the ones who are married. And so it doesn't take a promotion, but what it takes is a college degree to be in that group of women who are most likely to be married.
Oh, can I add?
Uh-huh.
What we found that stunned us is it's not just the college degree. The only group in society whose marriage rates have increased are the top 5% of women by income.
So maybe once upon a time, a manager would marry his secretary and call her a copywriter. Today, managers marry other managers, contributing to the age of inequality.
Yes,
exactly. Exactly. That's precisely what's happening. Managers do marry other managers, and yeah, it's women at the top who have not seen their marriage rates go down over the past 40 years since just after the Mad Men era. And
is it too broad a question to ask why?
Well, that's of course, we spent an entire book answering that question. But a big part of our answer is that when you look at what both men and women want, they want a partner. They want a partner who complements their sense of themselves, where they're going, who's going to help them to get there, with whom they can juggle, you know, trading off, picking up the kids after work, paying the bills. The men do not want to support families. They want somebody who's going to help them support their families. The women want somebody who they can trust, they can rely on, but they see themselves as in it together. Now, if you're going to be in it together, you need to have some idea where you're going to land before you can figure out the right partner. I had two children living in Washington, D.C. right after college, and my sense is everybody was looking around their shoulder at everybody else. Should I be going to graduate school? Do I need to leave this job and move to another city to advance my career? Is the person I'm with somebody who is speeding me along or holding me back? And it's not Pride and Prejudice. It's not cold-blooded calculation. It's, does the person I'm with make me feel good about myself? Do I feel we're getting there together, or are we moving in opposite directions? If you don't know where you're going to land or where the next job is coming from, that's hard to figure out.
So, listeners, how much do you need your lover to know that or to make, just financially, before you'll marry him or her? 212-433-WNYC, or tell us a story along these lines from your life. 212-433-9692. And Robert in Boreham Hill, you're on WNYC. Hi, Robert.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for taking the call. It's a great topic, actually.
Glad you're here.
About three years ago, I asked my girlfriend to move in with me, my wife. And I was, I had saved money from being a writer and things I had done, but I was sort of in between. I really wasn't sure what I was going to do. And I asked her to move in, and she said no. She said, start a business, get a job, do something, because I don't think it's right that I move in with you just to make things easier. And that wasn't really why I asked her. And I was truly insulted and truly hurt by this. And I called all of my friends. I called my family. I called my dad and told them I'd asked her to move in and what she had said. And every single one of them said, good for her.
Wow.
Good for her for not just moving in with you just to make it easier or just because it's time or because you love each other. She wanted to kick you in the butt a little bit. And it worked. I started a business. It took off. we moved in and we got married. But we talk about those days, about how she was working still in film and television and doing very well and in the union and picked up a lot of the slack of the relationship. I mean, it's not like I was living hand to mouth, but if we wanted to go to a great restaurant or we wanted to go away, it was on her.
Do you still write?
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, it's things that, you know, once you... you're in a relationship and a lot of the pressure goes away of dating. I found that I was, things went very well for me, but she said no. And it was a good 6 or 8 months before I said, gee, I better do something. Cause I shouldn't just not do anything. It's just stupid.
What do you think about the gender roles there? Like if it was the opposite, if you were the one in her career position and you had a girlfriend who was in your position and you loved her, do you think you would have asked her to move in? It's a hypothetical,
no,
I realize.
No. I wouldn't have. I would. It took me 3 years and a kind of a successful business and us being married for me to look back and go, she was right. And if I was in her position, I would have said the exact same thing.
Robert,
if I was dating a girl who was sort of lost professionally, I would probably have to insist that she sort of get it together before we figure yourself out, and then we'll figure us out.
Robert, thank you very much. And there, Naomi and June, is your book in a nutshell.
That's precisely it. And it helps also explain why the age of marriage is moving up. People want financial stability and emotional maturity from their partners before they get married. And so the age of marriage has increased over the past 50 years for both men and women.
By the way, the tweets on I'll Know I've Made It When are still streaming in, and they're amazing, so keep them coming. We'll read a whole bunch of them on the air as we go through our family meeting on making it here on The Brian Lehrer Show for the next couple of hours. Check out our Twitter feed, see where people are posting at Brian Lehrer, to see the way other listeners are filling in the blank. Benjamin on Twitter just wrote, I'll know I've made it when the parole board decides I've paid my debt to society. How about for you? You'll know you've made it when. You can tweet that in 140 characters at Brian Lehrer. Mary in Manhattan, what do you need in a partner before you would consider marrying him or her? Mary, you there?
Yes. Sorry. Hi, Brian.
So, yeah, you called to talk about money and dating?
Yeah. So I'm 34 years old. I'm a dentist. I make very good money. And when I'm dating, I am very conscious of how much he makes. And I think it's very important that he makes as much as I do, if not more. I bring a lot to the table. And honestly, I want somebody who brings as much. And maybe that's why it's been such a struggle. Maybe that's why I'm 34 and still looking. And as you were saying earlier, that the age of marriage has gone up. I have a lot of friends who are in the same situation and same age, same level of education, if not higher.
And do you find difficulty in finding guys who are making as much as you are as a dentist?
Yeah, I do. It hasn't been easy.
Why do you need that?
I think as I've gotten older, I feel that financial security is very important. And when I think about having kids and giving them all the opportunities that I've had and that I can give, I want somebody to be able to be on the same page as that, I guess.
Can you fill in the blank? I'll know I've made it when?
When I've found the right partner to have a family with. That's the state I'm in right now in my life.
Mary, good luck out there. Thank you very much. Back to Twitter. DJ, I'll know I've made it when I'm working hard because I want to, not because I have to. Joey, I'll know I've made it when I have a washer and dryer in my apartment in New York City. Gina, I'll know I've made it when I can go grocery shopping without checking my bank balance. So Naomi and June, authors of Marriage Markets, How Inequality is Remaking the American Family. You're right that the American reality that inspired your book is that divorce and out-of-wedlock births have become markers of class. What are some of the stats that show us that divide?
Well, let's start with divorce.
Go ahead,
Okay, and you can talk about non-marital births. When you look at divorce, there was a chart we saw from Sarah McClanahan's work that stunned us. And it showed the divorce rate.
And she's a sociologist at Princeton.
And what she showed is, you know, in the 90s, we started hearing divorce rates are leveling off. And then we saw these numbers. They weren't leveling off. They were moving in two opposite directions. So if you look at college graduates as a group, the divorce rates by 2004 were back to what they had been in the mid-60s, before the sex revolution, before no-fault divorce. And if you ask why, it is this later age of marriage and like marrying like, people finding somebody they think are real partners. For everyone else, divorce rates were continuing to go up. So you had the family moving in two diametrically opposed directions at the same time by class.
And what's the relationship between money or class and the divorce rates? Poorer people can't be happy together?
No, you know, this is one of the things we've spent a lot of time on, and it's hard to separate. But Paul Amato, another sociologist, has a great book that kind of captures this. And what he describes is, let's take two career couples. If you look at college graduates and you look at people who really have careers, well, they're not spending any time together, but conflict is way down and the relationships are pretty stable. If you look at the working class and you look at women who are working full-time and don't want to be, they are very divorce-prone. They want to be spending more time at home with the kids. They feel their husbands are not successful in bringing home enough money to allow them to take care of the family. And at the same time, we find that men who are unemployed or underemployed help out less at home than men who are fully employed. If the men feel good about themselves, they help out. If they feel they are unsuccessful, then the women are pestering them. And the men help out less. And this triggers something that really undermines relationships. So you've got this pressure to perform. And again, it's tougher in many ways for the working class. People who are doing reasonably well trade off. There are a number of arrangements, but they feel good about themselves. If they don't feel good about themselves, or if work has become much more unstable, men are much more likely, especially working-class men with high school degrees, to be cycling in and out of the labor market. That's destructive.
And Naomi, you want to pick that up?
I want to add that we're talking generally about statistics. We're not talking about any individual people, which is why the people who are calling in, the people who are responding on Twitter, their experiences won't necessarily always match what the statistics show. So, of course, you don't need money or you don't need a college degree to be happy in your marriage. But statistically, you're more likely to remain in your marriage for a longer period of time if you have an annual income, say, over $50,000, and if you have a college degree. So we're talking quite generally as opposed to about any specific relationship.
But wasn't it the opposite in the past, or is that a myth, that the more working class Americans would stay together and the wealthier Americans, especially, let's say, in the 1970s, when a lot of, I think, middle and upper middle class divorces started to happen as, you know, women started to feel their oats of independence and want to get out of these feminine mystique marriages, Mad Men era marriages that were holding them back, and people in the working class would look down their noses at the wealthier people who were looking for some, you know, highfalutin notion of satisfaction.
Actually, we present that a little differently. What you see is that the divorce rates go up for everybody in the 70s. But they do so in pretty parallel fashions. College graduates are still less likely to divorce, but the divorce rates are going up for both groups. What's different about the working class used to be more likely to marry. The top women, especially by income, were less likely to marry. They're more likely to marry now. So that's changed. But the big thing that's changed is what working class marriages are about. So in the old days, what happened is, you know, the marriage occurred because typically the woman got pregnant, reached in 1960s, close to a third of brides gave birth within 8.5 months of the nuptials, a figure last seen in 1800. But after they got married, what happened is the men could get jobs. They went off to work. They hung out with the guys. The women were in bed, you know, the women hung out with their families, their sisters, their mothers, and they raised the kids. And they had roles that didn't require they spend a lot of time with each other. Right now, that's a lot more complicated. Woman is more likely to be working and to feel she has to work. She needs the man to help out. The working class model, which is you get married after she gets pregnant, involved two people who don't know each other very well at the time the pregnancy occurs, which is different from the college graduate model.
Mm-hmm.
That still happens. The difference is today that group doesn't marry and doesn't necessarily have very much in common at the time the baby is born. And so the systems that took a man with no skills, high school degree, put him in a job and kept him there with promotions and benefits and status. And a system that said to the woman, okay, you're going to take care of the kids, that's a meaningful role, and you have this help from your family in doing it. That system's gone.
It's our family meeting on Making It on The Brian Lehrer Show today. We're asking on Twitter, you'll know you've made it when, fill in the blank, and Mercy tweets us, I'll know I've made it when I don't have to have a roommate anymore. And then she adds in another tweet, and I have an air conditioner. God bless summer in New York. And Tessa tweets, I'll know I've made it when my child no longer asks for money. And in this segment, we're asking you on the phones, how much do you need your lover to make before you'll marry him or her, as we talk about making it and marriage. And Richard in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Richard.
Hi, how you doing, Brian?
Good.
I'm gay, and what I'm finding now is that to bring this up to the 21st century, on some of the gay social apps and networking apps like Grindr, you'll find guys who say, if you want to meet for one night, that's fine, but relationships require a credit score of 700 or above.
Ooh,
now, I don't even know my credit score.
That's direct.
I should, but what the hell? I mean, I can't believe that. And I'm actually underemployed right now. I'm one of those guys with a lot of education who are unemployed. And I'm finding I go on, I see what I'm doing because I have a part-time job with the government. And then, boom, period. It's vacant. Nothing happens. So, I mean, it's still going on. And people, I mean, there are guys who I still can't get over. There's guys who require credit scores. I'm sorry, that's my rant.
Could it be that credit scores reflect something that's not just income, but like responsibility, dependability, paying your bills? I'm guessing you can have a relatively low income but a relatively high credit score if you've always paid your bills.
I guess. I don't even know my credit score, so yeah. I don't know.
Right. So that's your rant. Richard, thank you very much. And I may be wrong about that. Maybe you need a high income to have a credit score of 750. Just speculating there.
Can I add something about marriage as a market?
Yeah.
I mean, it's when we titled the book Marriage Market, people keep saying, well, marriage isn't a market. Marriage is always based on love. It's based on romance. It's based on soulmates. And yet, I mean, your question, how much does your lover need to make before you get married, this last person's response shows that some people really do think of marriage as a market. And even if you don't think of marriage as a market, there are still all kinds of supply and demand parts of getting married and of who you'll choose to get married.
So how fundamentally do you think this means that the meaning of marriage has changed in the last 50 years? Because Richard identifies himself as gay. As more gays and lesbians crave marriage, it seems more straight people are becoming wary of it. And the idea of making it as a married household is shifting under our feet, maybe in several directions at the same time.
Absolutely. No, you know, some of what we were describing and some of the conversations we have with more conservative scholars is about this idea of gender. So if you take the old model, it's the man in the Mad Men era was expected to take care of his wife, and but he could get a job if he wanted one. Now, no guarantee you can get a job. And if the man was expected to take care of her, she was expected to defer to him. He was the boss. He's the head of the family. Now you ask the question, what is marriage about? It's not about that. It's not about somebody taking care of someone else who is completely dependent. And one of the things we wrote about in our last book that we're excited about is we see same-sex relationships as really part of a move away from these rigidly defined gender roles to redefine the meaning of partnership. In Minnesota, which is a very marriage-oriented place, and we have same-sex marriage as a result of a ballot initiative, and then the legislature adopted it right after that, you can see that there is a shift toward greater emphasis on marriage as the sign of commitment, but not gender as the defining element.
Right.
That's complicated.
But conservatives, I think, would flip the script in another way, many of them, that rather than the age of inequality causing single parenthood, they would say rampant single parenthood is causing the age of inequality, that if a child is in a home with two adults, they could be gay or they could be straight, no matter what roles they take on in the relationship. But at least one works full-time at any job. I saw a stat the other day. 95% of those kids are not living in poverty. So how do you address the chicken and the egg question there between single parenthood and inequality?
Well, on that we say that if you have two people with marginal employment who are each below the poverty line and you put them together, you're still going to have a poor household. And so the real answer, what we argue, is that if you want to do anything, if we as a society want to do anything about single parenthood, then the real answer is creating more economic security for both men and women.
And we say something a little more complicated. I would say on the point Naomi just made, we're having a dialogue with some conservative writers who say they agree that you're not going to see the family strengthened without jobs, especially for blue-collar men. But we make a more complex argument in the book, and it goes like this. What greater inequality has done is to change the way men and women match up. So at the top, take all college graduates, take median as opposed to mean figures, and that is, take the numbers, don't take averages, and you find men have been the big winners. There are a lot more high-income men seeking to pair with a smaller number of successful women. When that happens, marriage rates tend to increase. Now take what's happening to the rest of society. Men have been the big losers. They are not as economically secure as they were 40 years ago. But women are better off. So what's happening is you're writing off an extraordinary percentage of men at the bottom due to mass incarceration, chronic unemployment, substance abuse. Men who don't hold full-time jobs don't feel good about themselves and aren't good partners. They're effectively unmarriageable. And what that means is you have a larger number of women and a smaller number of men. In every society where that happens, divorce goes up, marriage declines, non-marital births increase. It's true in France after World War II. It's true in lots of societies.
Marie in Cliffside Park, you're on WNYC. Hi, Marie.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good. What's your story?
Good. So I'm 26 years old, and I've always considered myself very idealistic. Just like a lot of young people my age, I thought marriage was about love and not so much about income. But I actually surprised myself last year when I had to make a really tough decision. I had been going out with this guy for about 3 years. We were pretty serious, and I was starting to think about the next step. And I am a college graduate, and I have a pretty secure job. I make more than $75,000 a year. And although he had a full-time job, he was not a college graduate. And I saw that my goals or the stability and security that I was looking for wasn't going to be available with him in the long run. And as much in love as I was with him, I didn't see him being that dependable or that secure. And it's funny, I was listening to you talk about credit score and what that really means, not necessarily income-wise, but as far as it relates to behaviors and paying your bills on time. And I think that you're very right. I think you hit it right on the money where, you know, you want to believe that you can marry an artist and live this very romantic life. But when it comes to having a stable relationship and being married in the long run and not thinking about divorce, you do need that level of stability. And I ended up breaking up with him. I lost interest in him because I didn't see him as my partner. I didn't see him challenging me and being my real equal. So
did anybody you know call you cold and calculating and too unromantic?
No. I mean, because I think I have both polar opposites. I am very romantic, and but I do feel that I need someone who's going to share the same views in life and the long-term views. I don't know if it affects any because I'm a female, and I do come from a very traditional household where my mom was a housewife, but mm-hmm. I can tell you that, like, I was looking for someone who was as stable as I was or even more stable in the sense of security and financial security. And
did you find someone?
No, but, I mean, at this point in my life, I'm just trying to focus on my career and my education. I didn't go to graduate school, and I'm thinking about going to graduate school. So if he happens to come along, then great, but I'm not necessarily looking to get married right away.
Marie, thank you very much. You contributed to the conversation a lot. I can see a lot of heads nodding out there and maybe a few people tisking and saying, she'll never get married, but probably not true. Nicola in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nicola.
Hi, Brian. So I wanted to basically address this to your authors. They were saying about higher income women being more likely nowadays to get married. And I think it may be different in the black community where I have a kid sister who's in her middle 30s. And she's finding it very difficult to meet a guy who's on her level. She's got a PhD in psychology. She's gone into private practice on the side while holding a full-time job at a university. And she's finding it really difficult to meet men.
June, Naomi, want to talk to Nicola?
Again, statistically, that's absolutely right. When we talk about marriage markets, there are different marriage markets, and race is certainly one of those factors in a marriage market. And if you look at the number of kind of men with comparable education to your friend, then that's absolutely right. There are fewer men in that market. So yeah, there are all kinds of different kinds of marriage markets that play out based on not just education, but also based on race. And the black marital rate at all incomes and for all educations is lower than the white marital rate.
June Carbone and Naomi Kahn, as we are out of time for this segment, are the authors of Marriage Markets, How Inequality is Remaking the American Family. Thanks for contributing so much to our family meeting on Making It today.
And thanks for helping us make it on your show.